Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half, the New Statesman's Culture Podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
Kate, before we go any further, I think you should fill us in on your Euro Disney adventure, because last time we were sitting in this room recording, you were just about to rush off.
I was in haste.
The Eurostar.
Yes.
So how did it go?
It hasn't changed. It's the same as it was maybe when I last went five or six years ago, but it will change in the next 3 years. Major overhauls are happening at Euro Disney, Disneyland Paris, as they call it.
Big structural changes.
Massive structural thematic alterations are taking place. They're going to knock a third of it down and build Frozen Land. Which is, you know, kind of asking for it, isn't it?
That's overdue,
quite a good idea.
Surely, Frozen
well
Land.
Well overdue.
So they have a Frozen ride
I
already?
They've got lots of... No, they've got no Frozen at all. They've got the old sort of... When you go
WTF.
Into the sort of, I know. And the worst part about Euro Disney is this terrible bit that nobody likes called Tomorrowland, which is the kind of retro-futuristic half-assed thing where you go to see Lilo and Stitch or play a laser game with Buzz Lightyear. And all these things that no one cares about anymore. So, yeah, and that's where Space Mountain is. And Space Mountain, of course, is the biggest roller coaster in Disney. And even that had a sad trajectory from being this kind of thing that paid tribute to the earliest silent movies, like the Lumiere kind of brothers era. Now it's the Star Wars ride. So it's exactly the same structure, but they just changed the paraphernalia
changed the
around
dressing.
It. Yeah.
Do they still have a Michael Jackson film? That's gone.
No, exactly. So they kind of, you know, they sort of do this thing where they take out things that aren't very fashionable anymore, but they haven't really actually sort of restructured it. So that will happen. But no, it was good. Small World is exactly the same as it ever was, as enchanting as ever. And there were lots of characters walking around, including Frollo from Hunchback of Notre Dame, which I thought was a nice French twist on it. Although I still find it weird that the characters in the ride speak French just because it's in Paris.
Aren't they? Because someone I know went there recently with their children, and maybe you didn't go this far, but you can have an audience with the Disney princesses.
You can. We didn't go into that.
No, but apparently the Disney princesses are all sort of like UN envoys, like multilingual. They can just like switch between French, English, German, you know. Maybe they know their spiel.
But the highest level of pay for a Disney character. I mean, I just think it's ridiculous. You're going through Pirates of the Caribbean and the Johnny Depp, Jack Sparrow that pops out of the kind of wine barrel is speaking in French. And then suddenly it goes, "A pirate's life for me," in Johnny Depp's voice. And you're like, this is just too much. But yeah, so I would say don't go, but then go in 3 years' time and go to Frozen Land.
Just briefly, because you mentioned the, what's his name? The Hunchback of Notre Dame guy?
The Hunchback, Claude Frollo.
Frollo.
No, not the Hunchback. This is the Archdeacon.
He's the baddie, right? Yeah, he's the baddie. Because you've written in this week's magazine about Disney villains.
Mm.
What have you noticed about that? What was
I think
the theme that you picked up?
Disney villains, Disney doesn't have the guts to make a proper villain nowadays. So if you look back to the original, the kind of Maleficent, the Snow White, Sleeping Beauty kind of era, they were just evil people who did things
pure
like
evil.
Put a curse on a baby because they weren't invited to a party. things like that. No backstory. And then there was a kind of a development whereby when there was this Disney Renaissance in the 90s with Aladdin and all the other ones, they actually started to write backstories for the characters, for the baddies. So they might be motivated by lust and greed and things, which is fair enough. And then now you've got these terribly wishy-washy characters that aren't actually really baddies at all, and that part of the trajectory of the film is like working out what their motivations are. So I think that they need to kind of just get some guts and write some pure evil again, because it seems a strange time in history to be not allowing children to face something that might just be like a genuine asshole in a story. It's like, why are they asking the motivations of why this person is as bad as they are? Did they have a bad childhood or, you know?
Well, it's not only motivation, is it? They're sort of giving them a little bit of a chance for redemption and for you to go away after the film feeling like the baddie wasn't really a baddie after all.
Yeah, like even in Frozen, you've got this sort of, you know, the Snow Queen is a very terrifying prospect in Hans Christian Andersen. It's kind of translated to Elsa. This sort of very, very relatable. I hate the word relatable, but very sort of lovely, like young girl. And then you've got the Marshmallow, the monster, the ice monster, who's shown having a kind of character conversion at the end and wearing the little tiara and jumping around. And it's sort of, in a way, it's saying to children, don't worry, because there's no such thing as bad. And of course there is, as we know.
Yeah, and Moana, which my kids love, there is a terrifying creature in that, but once the thing that was stolen from it is restored to it, it kind of goes and just turns into a lovely island again.
It's okay, it's nothing to see here.
What are we going to be talking about today? The Booker Prize?
You're just back from the Booker.
Back from the Booker. Mm. It's Booker Week.
And we're talking about Fahrenheit 11/9, which is Michael Moore's new film. And we will have the umpteenth of our noniversaries, which are generally themed around the 90s, but not always. So, Tom, you attended the Booker Prize this year. Is it 50th? The 50th?
It's the 50th anniversary. So, they're even more excited than they were for the 40th anniversary. Mm.
And the 49th.
And the 49th anniversary. I mean, the Booker is, they've, over the past sort of decade, they've come up with more and more sort of special bolt-ons. It's like some computer game where you keep on buying like extra things to add to it. So we've had like the Golden Man Booker, the Booker of Bookers, the Lost Man Booker.
And these are extra prizes on top of the main one.
Just, you know, because it's a cake with icing and you keep needing more icing on top of the cake. But yes, there is buzz around it in its 50th year. We sat down in London's historic Guildhall on Tuesday evening, which is really impressive.
That's where we have some conferences.
Yeah, we've had a company conference there. Indeed, we have. So you're in the Great Hall, which is this medieval building in the middle of Guildhall. And Camilla Parker Bowles is there. She's the patron. So she gives her little speech about the importance of reading, and the man from Man, the man from the Man Group who sponsored the prize, gives his little speech about the importance of literature. And then eventually at the end of the evening, you find out who's won the Booker Prize.
Is there a real hierarchy of tables? And if so, what was the prime table that everyone wanted to be on?
Well, when I got there, I arrived with Jason Cowley, our boss and the editor of The New Statesman. And the man with the clipboard said, Jason, you're on table 3. Oh, Tom, you're on table 31. So I think it's fair to say that Jason had a better spot than I did.
And what were you on last year?
I was closer to the stage last year.
But last year you were sitting next to Tom Mashler, who actually invented the prize.
Founded the prize, and who features in this this documentary that we both watched.
Yes, who set it up because England is backwards in terms of literary appreciation, he said, in 1968.
He was fairly straight talking, wasn't he, Tom Mashler? Yes, he featured in Barney's Books and Bust-Ups. 50 years of the Booker Prize, which was quite a fun documentary shown this week about the history of the prize. It was funny actually, because this is significantly more name dropping than usually happens in the podcast. But Rachel Cook, who is our TV critic, had recently written a piece about the Booker, and one of the things she'd pointed out is that there had been complaints that journalists had been hived off on a sort of elevated dais, you know, at the far end of the hall.
A kid's table.
And where were me and Rachel? On the same table. on this basically kids platform at the end of the road. So
this year you'd read all of them this year, hadn't
I had
you?
I felt
you hadn't read the long list because you weren't a judge this
I
year.
I didn't read all of the long list. No, I wasn't a judge. Leo Robson, our chief fiction critic, was a judge, and I tried to pump information out of him at various points, but failed spectacularly. I'd read the long list, which kind of puts you in the minority, actually, going around the table. I was definitely the SWAT of the table, having read all the books on it. Yeah, so it was an interesting shortlist. Two American writers, Rachel Kushner and Richard Powers, who I kind of felt were quite high in the running. A verse novel by a poet called Robin Robertson about LA in the 40s and 50s and film noir, and narrated by an army veteran. Really interesting book. A debut novel by Daisy Johnson, based on the Oedipus myth, which you can very quickly say a debut novel based on the Oedipus myth. But actually, I was just thinking about that book the other day. That's quite a bold myth to take on. It's one of the more far out ones to just, you know, do kill your dad and have sex with your mum, which is what happens in that book.
In the modern day.
Yeah. So fair play to her.
Did you
hats off to Daisy for putting that off?
Did you feel, and one thing you always hear about, it's the same with music prizes, but there is often a genuine sense of surprise when the winner is announced, and presumably that's part of. I mean, bookies' favourites are very, very rarely sort of on the nose, aren't they? Were you surprised by the Anna Burns win for Millman?
Yeah, everyone was surprised. I mean, I mentioned the other books there because those are the books that people were talking about around the table. Those are the books that people had read. You know, people just hadn't read the Anna Burns. I think, you know, she's not a particularly well-known writer. She's in the mid-list. This is her third novel. She was shortlisted for a prize in 2002, but sort of has kind of disappeared since then. It looks quite difficult. It's quite hard to sell with a snappy one-liner. So yeah, people hadn't read it, so people were really, really surprised. But I'm thrilled for her, and there has been a kind of wave of good feeling about it. And interestingly, one thing that people were saying is, oh, booksellers are, I was saying this as well, booksellers are not going to be happy about this because it's
supposed to be a big
challenging
spike on the
Yeah, so you always get a big spike when you win the Booker Prize in sales. And obviously, booksellers want, from the Booker Prize, they want a book that's going to, you know, keep them well fed throughout the Christmas and the winter months. And they've got a bit grumpy because the last couple of years haven't been brilliant. And George Saunders, who won for Lincoln in the Bardo last year, was the lowest selling Booker winner for a decade.
Really?
Despite being a fantastic book, it's just, you know, it's a challenging novel.
The thing that I find funny about that is you think people would just buy it anyway and then find they can't get through it. So in terms of the sales, how does it affect? Do you think people just flick through and think, oh, I can't stomach that. It's got no paragraph breaks. It's got characters called somebody McSomebody, like you've got a milkman.
Yeah, I think it's partly a word of mouth thing. The George Saunders year is slightly unfairly skewed because this is a really technical point, but it does make a difference. If the book is already out in paperback, it sells many more copies than if it's still in hardback.
Yeah.
And the George Saunders one was still in hardback. So it's a bit more of an investment. But I think, word of mouth does count. And if people buy it and read it and don't get on with it, then they don't give six copies of it away at Christmas, which is, I think, you know, I certainly in my family, it's like, oh, it's the Booker winner.
It's the Booker.
Thanks.
Can you feel can you feel why it won?
Yes, I can. Yeah. I should say everyone knows all about it by now, but it's set in Belfast in the 70s, although it's totally removed from that setting. So there are no place names. There are no character names. It's about an 18-year-old girl who is being stalked by a much older man called the Milkman, who is not a milkman at all, but a quite sinister paramilitary figure. And nothing happens with this relationship, but the rumour mill of the community starts going, and it's decided that she's in a relationship with this guy. And this actually has really big consequences for her. So it's really interesting on sort of male coercion and control. I mean, people have talked about it in terms of Me Too, and obviously it was written well before that, but actually there's a passage in there where the narrator says, it's only 20 years on that I look back on this and think, hang on, why did I feel I had to be polite to this guy? Huh. I had to stand there and listen to him. I had to get in his van, you know. I couldn't acknowledge the fact that I was uncomfortable with it, which is obviously kind of something that is going on with a lot of people at the moment.
She said anything about where she took her inspiration from. She's quite sort of she's very private.
I'm interviewing her tonight, so I will try and tease some of that out. But she's very, very private. I mean, the setting is obviously based on her own childhood growing up. There's one very specific link, which is that the main character is marked out as being different, which is kind of a dangerous thing to be in this community where, you know, adhering to the norms is fairly highly prized by the fact that she walks around reading books. So she reads 19th century novels as she walks around the streets. And I know that that's something that Anna Burns did when she was a child. She talks about kind of reading Ivanhoe and Russian literature, kind of walking through these kind of dark streets with cracked street lights, you know, which is kind of is amazing when you think that the area that she grew up in, Ardoyne, which is a Catholic working class district of Northern Ireland, was one of the most dangerous parts of Northern Ireland during the Troubles. There's a separate page on Wikipedia just to list all the kind of killings that happened in Ardoyne. So it was a tough place to grow up. But one thing the book charts is how, you know, that becomes normalised and that just becomes part of your existence.
I mean, it has the same, the prize has the same response every year as a lot of the music awards as well, which is, oh, what's the point of it? You know, and they started saying that in the 90s, didn't they? What's the point of the Booker?
Yeah.
And why, I was wondering why this happens with prizes. Is it because people get smug about them or bored with the format, or you just kind of, you know, the press is all over them for the first couple of decades and then it becomes something that you just want to kind of kick and pick apart? Because there's no sign of this going anywhere, is there? I mean, it's £50,000 prize. It's the biggest book award in the world, isn't it? So why is there this kind of thing every year of like, you know, is it time to end the Mercuries? Is it time to end the Booker?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think one of the things that documentary teases out is how much fun people had with the prize in the past. And that definitely doesn't happen anymore because, you know, you've got this huge corporate sponsor, you've got an incredibly professional PR team. You just don't have the kind of public spats and bust ups and things that marked the early years of the Booker Prize.
Like Anthony Burgess saying it's a parochial prize for parochial novels.
Yeah,
or Kingsley Amis saying he's going to spend the money on booze.
Booze, of course, and curtains, he says.
What do they say they'll spend the money on now when they get up there? They probably can't even mention the money because it's so vulgar.
I think they occasionally make a joke. I think Hilary Mantel said something about a swimming pool. you get Joanna Lumley writing from her dressing room saying, over my dead body will this book win the Booker Prize? And you kind of have the Guildhall full of, or was it the Guildhall then? I don't know, but the room full of kind of billowing cigarette smoke and
I thought something was on fire.
Yeah, I know, it's amazing, isn't it?
It's just these smoke rings coming up. And then there was that amazing year in the 70s when John Berger like gave his money to the Caribbean.
Yeah, to the Black Panthers. Yeah.
Because the, you know, part of the Booker is part of the same movement that's exploiting poverty in the Caribbean as a result of things like the Booker. So I'm going to share my money with the Black Panthers.
Yeah, this is the original sponsor, Booker, which was a food, you know, food wholesaler. And I think they made money on sugar and things like that. So Burgess saying, you know, this is all from colonial exploitation.
That didn't go down very well, did it?
No, it didn't. I mean, I think the polite audience was completely shocked, but all of this stuff fed into headlines. I think then it was seemed enough for it to be a prize for the best book. Now it seems to have a real crisis of identity in that, yes, okay, it's still a prize for the best book, but should it be a book that is also challenging. Should it be a book that is going to be very popular? You know, should it include writers from outside the UK? Will it outside the UK and the Commonwealth? Well, it decided that it should.
Very recently.
Yeah, and that annoyed a lot of people.
Which seems strange, like the idea that suddenly just opening up America is going to destroy the whole nature of the prize. I mean,
yeah, I can see it both ways. I think it's given it. I mean, every prize has criteria that narrow it down, right? The you know, even now it's only for books in the English language or that are published in the UK. So it's always going to be a little bit arbitrary. And I think the argument is that it spread the net too far so that the kind of conversation about it becomes a bit too diffuse. But yeah, I mean, having said that, two of my favourite books of the last few years have been American winners of the Booker Prize, George Saunders and Paul Beatty.
I also think there's just something very powerful about nostalgia and hindsight with awards generally, that you can always look back 20 or 30 years and say, oh, I can't believe those two giants were up against each other. What's happened to the literary world now? We've got, you know, all these modernists, those sort of like experimental indie kind of projects sort of fighting each other and you know, maybe they're not going to go down in history in the same way and stuff. And your brain does something where you just think it was always better then because there were better books being written then.
Well, the Mercury is actually, it's a really good comparison actually, because I think it's exactly the same conversations that go on then. And you look back to like, oh, Massive Attack and, you know, that, you
pulp
know, that,
and Radiohead
that era
and,
in the 90s, yeah. Like with these giants fighting out. I mean, I think you can make a very broad point that this is all perhaps to do with the kind of atomization of culture and the fact that in those days you had the big newspapers covering these things. So there was one big conversation going on. And now there's lots of different conversations going on, and it's hard to recapture the idea of something being that kind of central in the culture.
And we might be rewarding, you know, maybe rewarding experimental work now, but we were then, it just was experimental for its time.
Yeah.
And that's why it just feels classic now.
Yeah.
And maybe this were, maybe, you know, Milkman will feel extremely classic in 20 years time. So I think there's always that going on. You can always sort of think, oh, you know, it used to be better than it is now.
Yeah, absolutely. The good old days.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Kate, we're extremely highbrow this week. We've gone from literature to politics. I mean,
oh no.
Can you imagine two people less well equipped to talk about literature?
Especially the publication least equipped to talk about these things as well.
Oh, Jesus. So we went to see Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 11/9, which is a neat reversal of his film, Fahrenheit 9/11.
And you went first and you warned me that of its sort of slightly sprawling nature and its length. And that really helped because then I thoroughly enjoyed it. Because I knew it was 2 hours, 10 minutes with an entire film about Flint shoved in the middle.
So can you summarise
what's
the, I mean, it starts with the question, Trump won the election. How the fuck did this happen?
Yeah.
So that's his kind of starting point. Where does he take it?
I mean, I think it's quite powerfully done, really. He focuses particularly on two states, Michigan and West Virginia, in order to explore the reasons that states like that stopped voting or went dramatically in the case of Michigan from part of the blue wall to a huge majority for Trump. So yeah.
And Moore is from Michigan.
Michigan. Yeah. And I get the feeling that, I mean, I don't know if this is true, but I get the feeling that he wanted to make a film about the Flint water crisis. I don't know how much this reached the rest of the world, but that Rick Snyder basically diverted all the drinking water from, I believe, from the lake to the river and poisoned dozens and dozens and dozens of inhabitants of Flint by putting it through lead piping that got into their water system. This is a huge scandal, but this actually happened on Obama's watch. So I get the feeling that, you know, this was sort of one of the greatest tragedies of recent years in politics. This was an overlooked state. This is an extremely poor state. And that he was investigating this all along. But it works out perfectly in his film, because then he can look at why these voters maybe didn't turn out. There's a really, really tragic section where Obama comes along to talk to the people of Flint and does this insane sort of press stunt of asking for a glass of drinking water on the podium and being seen to take a mouthful of it, which is like a kind of mega version of when John Gummer shoved the burger into his daughter's mouth during the BSE crisis. Here it's like the most insensitive thing you could do. It's saying like, it's all right for me. You know, I'm sure the water's all right now, kind of thing. And then went back to Washington. So he interviewed a lot of people who at the time said that was it for them, that Obama was their hero. And at that moment they lost the love for him. And they, you know,
it's extremely shocking. And I think it's the most successful part of the film, isn't it? Because this story seems to be a very black and white case of corruption, greed and callousness from the kind of corporate elite and from this awful Republican governor who, when it's discovered that the new water supply from the River Flint is basically poisonous and, you know, kids are being tested and they're found out that they've got lead poisoning, and the water is corroding parts in the General Motors automobile factory. So the General Motors factory is allowed to switch back to the clean supply from the lake while the population of Flint continues to have the river water. So it's a very, it's a very clear case for Moore to, and because it's his hometown as well, it's kind of, and it allows him to do some of his stunts as well. He goes to make a citizen's arrest of Governor Snyder, and he turns up at his house and tries to spray water over the fence.
Yeah, when
he's sort of semi-effective, but he's kind of like, he's got this hose and he's just sort of pours a little bit over the fence and then kind of packs up and goes home. So, the problem with the film, I guess, is as you say, tying that in with the rest of the narrative, because it didn't happen on Trump's watch. And there are other things that Moore is interested in, such as the Parkland shootings in Florida from earlier this year and the teacher strikes in West Virginia. And then he moves on to the new wave of left-wing candidates that have sprung up from those movements. And that's the point, I guess, where you get kind of a bit of optimism and a bit of a focal point for the film, that there might be some new hope springing out of all of this,
including one of our favorite characters in the film, Richard Ojeda, who is what is he now, what's his actual title, because he's an ex-marine.
Well, he's running in the midterms a seat in the House of Representatives. I mean, don't try and get me on.
He's just
American
gone down in the polls as well,
it?
I heard today. That. I know.
So describe this guy.
This
he's
is
amazing.
He's 47 years old. He's ex-Marine. Looks like he's a skinhead, basically. He's got 58 metal plates in his face, and he had 8 broken bones after being attacked 2 days before he won his state Senate seat. By a guy
you're going to say by some army.
No,
injury.
This is like, this is what politics is like in West Virginia. A guy told him at a cookout to go and stick a bumper sticker on his car and then tried to run him over with the car. The guy's now in prison for 5 years. So Ojeda voted Trump and then came back from 2 terms in, I don't know, Afghanistan or something, and saw that West Virginia, which is, I think, the poorest state in the US, had just rapidly declined while he'd been away. And was like, okay, and basically just had this huge conversion, became Democrat, and was, yeah, somebody even tried to kill him in the process of him running for his state Senate seat. So his pedigree is just incredible. And he's this extremely pumped up kind of aggressive guy that Moore meets in a coffee shop in West Virginia. And like he seems to start every sentence with, "I would fight you on the street." It's actually quite frightening to be around.
The second time he says that, Moore's like, how many people are, he's sort of like, my campaign manager is a long distance truck driver. He'll fight you in the street
he'll
too.
Fight you in the street.
Like, how many people have I got to fight?
It's an area of like struggling coal mines, opioid addiction, he mentions, left behind white voters, and teachers who are on so little money that they have to get food stamps. And so in West Virginia, there's one of the best bits of the film is this teacher strike, which ran for 9 days for better pay and for the overruling of some strange rule whereby in order to qualify for health insurance, I think, they had to wear a Fitbit to prove that they'd done a certain number of steps per month. And if they didn't, they had $500 docked from their pay or something like that. So this is this kind of like very fat mayor or whatever in Charleston who put all this through, and they striked against him for 9 days and they finally got their way.
He's the other, along with Snyder, he's the other baddie of the film, really,
yeah.
Isn't he? Like less so than, and more so even than Trump, Governor Jim Justice.
Yes.
He's this toad-like guy who sits in this chair. For 10 days, he holds out against these people. And then you finally see him signing the bill, which he does with the same sort of sickly smile.
He's smiling
I know.
He's like, oh, go on then,
He's
you
the
guys.
Richest man. He's a billionaire. He's the richest man in West Virginia.
Really?
Yeah, Governor Jim Justice. Moore plays this kind of Ennio Morricone soundtrack when he first introduces him as sort of some Western baddie.
It's a perfect example of like Moore's style. The editing in it is completely nuts. There's a section about Trump's racism and he's cut together various clips of Trump on the podium going, "You get out now," when as though he's pointing to a black person or a Mexican person, when of course he's just probably making a joke to one of his mates or something. And Moore gets away with editing all this stuff together. We all know Trump's racist, so
yeah,
he can do this to make his point. But it's very powerful filmmaking, and you get sucked into those that manipulation. I mean, that the thing that everyone's talking about is the fact that he dubs footage of Hitler with Trump's voice towards the end, and that's, you know, that is in our day and age, that is not a cool thing to do, but actually, why the fuck not?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, Paul Mason interviewed him for us in this week's magazine, and the point Michael Moore makes is that liberals are very reluctant to sort of play nasty. What's the word? Play dirty.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they like to be reasonable, and they don't want to do things like dub Trump over Hitler. But actually, you know, that's what they've got to do if they want to win. So yeah, that's fair enough. But yeah, certainly as a kind of British metropolitan elite film goer, you feel really uncomfortable about this stuff.
And Paul also said, like, there was a gasp in the screening when the Hitler footage came on. Everyone went, he's like, well, come on, why not?
Yeah. And he does also, I mean, one bit which I felt went too far, and I also was just confusing, was he had this whole section about the Reichstag fire, which, you know, was supposedly staged by the Nazis in order for Hitler to be able to clamp down on the Communist Party. And then it sort of weirdly towards the end merged with sort of 9/11 footage.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, what?
He says in the film, I think we're just one 9/11 away from Trump being able to turn on the screws. And it's like, it's basically, it's conspiracy theory stuff, isn't it? It's like, you know, all he needs to do is make another 9/11 happen. And I mean, I thought, that was quite a stretch as well. But on the flip side, that, you know, he has this incredible 99-year-old Nuremberg lawyer that he interviews, who's this razor sharp guy who's talking about the separation of families on the Mexican border and various other things. And at one point he says, you know, I hanged people for doing that, and it's happening now in America. And he starts crying.
Yeah.
So, and you think someone who was at those trials is crying over the state of America now, and they're not even an American. It's, you know, I thought that was quite, I think it sort of packs a lot of punches in quite a strange patchwork sort of setting as a film, and it's, you just have to sit through it, really.
There are a few laughs as well, aren't there? I mean, I know he's a Hillary supporter, but he's quite ruthless on the failings of the Democrat Party.
Yeah.
And the complacency as well. And at the beginning, you see the kind of lots of clips of pundits kind of chuckling over the fact that Trump's going to win and saying, oh, he'll never win. You know, why are you even asking me that? And then the kind of the absolute confidence of the Democrats on the night of the election.
Yeah.
This huge rally, you know, I believe that we will win. And the Trump gang is sort of really somber. And, it reminds you what a surprise that was. And then you see Hillary kind of like on the stage, thanks to Jay-Z and Beyonce and Chance the Rapper,
yeah.
You know, like, and Moore's voiceover goes, she has no idea who any of these people are.
But when it showed Trump coming on after he'd won, I'd forgotten all about that. And it's interesting how quickly you forget these things. It was just like with Brexit, that there was a feeling of, he didn't want this to happen.
He says, never did a group of people look so sad to win the presidency.
Yeah. And that was like, I just erased that from memory, that he's standing there with his kids and they just look like, oh my God, what are we going to do now? And it's sort of, you know, it was all just a game and it worked.
Well,
you know?
Just finally, the point he makes about it being just a game is that he playfully blames the whole thing on Gwen Stefani.
Yeah.
Because when Trump finds out that she's getting paid more on The Voice, is it? Then he is
on The Apprentice.
On The Apprentice, right? That she's better paid than him. He decides to kind of stage this fake, you know, running for office.
Yeah, and that's where it all began.
And, and he just sort of ends up having to see it through. Amazing. Fahrenheit 11/9 is out in cinemas now. It's now time for our non-anniversary, which is our anniversary of a culturally significant or possibly culturally insignificant event, depending on your perspective. This one is fairly significant for both of us and
for all of you.
Makes us feel pretty old, I think.
Old and moved.
Old and moved.
It is, 26 years since Sleeping Satellite by Tasman Archer was number one. For a short time in the UK, it was in 90s Pedigree Company because it knocked Ebenezer Good off the charts with Ease of Good. And it was replaced by End of the Road by Boyz II Men.
What a trio.
I know.
What a triple whammy. The Ebenezer Good was number one for 4 weeks.
Mm.
And Sleeping Satellite only got two, which seems...
Which is amazing because it was so radio friendly that it just... I mean, it just shone out of the radio,
yeah.
Didn't it? It was beautiful. It was just this kind of otherworldly, luminous kind of song. And she never had a hit with anything else. She co-wrote it with her partner. They went on to write some music for EastEnders. But they never had another hit.
She's British?
She's British. And she's with a guy called John Hughes, who's also a musician. They wrote it together and she got the 1993 Brit Award for Best British Breakthrough Act, which is so classic, on one song. But she later joked that she kept the award in the back of her kitchen cupboard and used it for cracking nuts and tenderizing steak because she wasn't really a pop star. And then she began to paint and mold with clay.
Do you think that's what she's doing now?
Who knows? I imagine they probably live quite well off Sleeping Satellite. I imagine you could probably bring in 50 grand a year off that.
I hope
that's my estimate.
I mean, also stuck out as being a song about something, about the Apollo moon landings. And I just watched a video for the first time, which is quite odd. It's like a haunted, well, not really a haunted house. It's a kind of old scientist's lair with sort of Faraday globes. And
she's like standing under a starry dome.
She's just slowly rotating throughout the whole song. And there's a sort of Darwin figure with a white beard slumped in an armchair, and then a little cherub with wings comes in. I've no idea.
I like the idea with songs like this. I always like to think when somebody just had one hit and it was about something, a bit like American Pie. I know he had other hits, Don McLean, but just a kind of inspiration of something that was not about you and not about love and loss and the usual sort of subjects of pop songs, but literally about like something in popular culture that inspired you and you just decided to write this song about, and then that was it.
Also, what a great, you know, poets spend their whole life coming up with moon metaphors, and the sleeping satellite is a great, it's one of the great moon metaphors.
That's the moon,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Happy nonniversary, Tasman Archer. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. Kate, are you okay?
I'm just doing some typing.
Kate was very moved by our little spot on Sleeping Satellite. And
now I'm logging onto my email while you finish the podcast.
Going to go away and listen to it for the rest of the day and think about what she's done over the past 26 years. Yes, thank you for downloading this episode of our podcast, which we like to call The Back Half. We've been edited by Caroline Crampton. Do go onto iTunes and rate us and tell your friends about us. And we're going to leave you with
a banging tune, which is Godspeed by the Japanese jazz rock outfit Pistol Jazz.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.